the NURA Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College, and he's here to take me on a trip through the new world and a new word to me, intermestic. This turns on an article I've read by Christopher Sabatini, a senior research fellow for Latin America at Chatham House. He's also a senior lecturer at the London School of Economics and Political Science, writing about the word intermestic. And the irony here is, once upon a time, the U.S. dominated the new world. That no longer is said to be the case, perhaps because of inattention, perhaps because those economies have grown. We can mention the intervention, interference, strange masked conduct of our adversaries in the new world. There are a lot of reasons why we've lost contact or now have troubled relations. There are several states that the trouble is profound. We've spoken of Colombia. That necessarily isn't a threat, but there's El Salvador with Mr. Bukele going for another term somehow. There's Guatemala and Honduras. Those three countries make up the Northern Triangle. And they also describe the migrant crisis that we've talked about these last years at the Texas and California and Southwest borders. So, Evan, let's begin with this wonderful new word to John, intermestic. Intermestic. What does that mean, Professor?
John, intermestic is a political science term that talks about the mutual influence of domestic policy and in foreign policy. And Latin America is a great example of that. Essentially, it's the argument that we've been making on this program for a long time, which is that Latin America is critical to U.S. Prosperity, the U.S. economy, to U.S. supply chains. When things go bad in Latin America, we feel it critically in the United States through things like migrant flows. We feel it through things like drug flows. And so the fact that things are going very badly and increasingly badly, not only in economic terms and security terms, but also in political terms in Latin America, really impacts us. And we find ourselves actually trying to do things in our engagement to the region that were unthinkable just a few years ago. You go all the way back to, for example, Barack Obama, when you had the child migrant crisis, that suddenly, although we couldn't come up with $1 billion for helping to Latin American prosperity, we suddenly had to come up with $2.7 billion to deal with a migrant crisis on the U.S. side. And so what you find now, and it's an increasingly worrisome thing, is that as the region has deteriorated across the board, not only the economic situation, but as that has brought relatively left-oriented governments who have been increasingly less and less disposed to follow the U.S. lead. So, for example, Mexico, as we've talked about with the AMLO regime, who has been less willing to cooperate with us on drug policy. Petro in Colombia, one of our closest allies that we've talked about, who again was just talking with Secretary Blinken about a revolutionary change in moving away from working with the U.S. on counter narcotics and counterterrorism to a new type of engagement. Nayib Bukele, and others who in previous years, the United States had the economic and institutional leverage with others in the region to say, hey, you need to take care of what you're doing and not go in these anti-democratic or corrupt directions. And essentially, you have Bukele now being able to leverage, Chinese money and others, essentially thumbing his nose at us for a very different reason. The relatively U.S. friendly regime of Giametti in Guatemala, who when we objected to essentially his attorney general having credible evidence that she was protecting organized criminals. He basically thumbed his nose with us for that. So across the region, what we're finding is that this is becoming a more and more serious problem. Indeed, it was interesting that, again, the Organization of American States just had October 6th and 7th, its 52nd General Assembly, which used to be a pretty big deal. We saw that previously, when the U.S. called a Summit of the Americas, that was lost in bickering about who the United States didn't want to invite. And at this most recent OAS meeting that occurred just days ago, not only did nobody talk about it, but the agenda itself, some of the things that the U.S. wanted to put on the table were absolutely lost. And so, again, it underlies the degree to which the conditions in the region are impacting us as a domestic issue as much as it is impacting us just as a foreign policy issue.
On his way to the meeting, the Secretary of State, we've talked about his visit with President Petro, recently elected. He also, I understand, visited with President Boric in Chile on his way to visit with President Castillo in Lima, Peru. What do we know about the conversations with Gabriel Boric, who's a very young man, has great ambitions, but has recently been stymied by a rejection of a new constitution?
Well, John, actually, at least so far, although there are some concerns about where some of Boric's economic policy and the difficulty that he's having in constitutional reform and getting his really statist legislative agenda through, although there are some problems in the possibility for that really leading to significant economic and other crises in Chile. But Boric himself, at least one of the most positive things for me has been that he's at least been willing to stand up as a principled advocate of democracy. He's been outspoken against Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. He's been outspoken against basically the authoritarian dictatorships that you have in Venezuela and in Nicaragua and in other things. And so my sense was that after a relatively difficult conversation by Secretary Blinken with Gustavo Petro in Colombia, that the conversation that he had with Boric in Chile was much more positive, at least focused on rights and democratic values and things like that. And so I think that's that was certainly a positive development.
And on to Peru, Lima, Peru. Evan, we've mentioned this often over the last year. Peru was very badly hit by the pandemic. People could not stay inside. They traveled to the countryside. We don't have really good statistics. It's gone through several changes of government. Pedro Castillo is a disappointment, even to his own supporters, people who recommended him, a rookie in the world of international politics. What can be done for Peru? Because it seems of all the states we've discussed today, the one that's least able to help itself.
John, frankly, Peru desperately needs stability, and it desperately needs a return to good governance. Peru is sitting on a mountain of wealth. You throw a rock and you find, essentially mineral wealth, whether it's copper or iron, and especially with relatively high prices, Peru has been living on that. Indeed, actually, mining investment in Peru, one of the bright sides, actually increased by 40% this year over the previous year. And there's at least some hope that Peru will have positive economic growth this year, largely because of that mining sector. However, having said that, the problem is that Peru is becoming increasingly fragmented after having a series of presidents before getting to Castillo. And now, of course, with Castillo himself having gone through literally 72 or more cabinet ministers and I think at least four governments, with Castillo also having dealing with the Congress, who has six ongoing investigations against him and is actively looking for ways to bring charges and possibly even remove him for what they call moral incapacity. But even the Congress itself recently deposing its interim leader, Lady Camiones, to put in power a new leader, former General Jose William Zapata. And so what you get is just so much churn right now in Peru, which just creates so much political uncertainty, which creates so much investment uncertainty. And so what Peru really needs is and Peru actually just had regional elections, and that made matters even worse because some of the national parties lost ground to some of the more locally popular, essentially the strongman parties that represent the local bosses, the Cadillos in Peru. And so what Peru really needs is a return to stability that lets it leverage the enormous wealth that it has in the country.
The article by Christopher Sabatini, I take from it, there's an irony here that once the U.S. gave out orders and policy was obeyed, now the smaller states have needs that the U.S. must bow to in some fashion. But it comes back to immigration. That's the intermestic policy that matters of all. People are coming to the United States because their states, their countries don't provide for them and their families. That's true for Venezuela. So I come to the puzzle. Is López Obrador, the president of Mexico, is he the new leader of Latin America?
John, there are so many different new leftist regimes, and each one of them, going back to their own history, has a desire to be the new leftist leader. Mexico, if you go back to the regime, for example, in the 70s, Luis Echeverria had a certain amount of influence, especially over Central America and the Caribbean. And clearly some of the language you see from AMLO now would suggest a desire to go back to that. But it only goes so far. But you do see, and especially with a person who would like to become Mexico's president, the current foreign minister, Marcelo national, but are a certain desire to project that kind of, you know, leftist leadership. But if you also look to Petro, if you look at Petro's UN speech and you look at some of the things that Petro has said in to Secretary Blinken and elsewhere, it's very clear that Petro would aspire to be a new grandiose Latin American leader, although others may have a different opinion. Lula da Silva, Brazil has always been relatively equivocal about its relationship to the rest of the region, but Lula, in many ways, because Brazil is half of all of South America, has certain aspirations to be one of the key leftist leaders of the region. Nicolas Maduro, although people have stopped listening as he's destroyed his economy and become a narco state, has long since had that desire. And so there's really kind of a cacophony of leftists who desire to do so. But along the way, as you point out, what we really do also have is that none of those countries, for various different reasons, are particularly interested in cooperating with us, either on good economic policy that would keep their migrants at home with decent opportunities there, nor with working with us on drugs and security issues or migration itself. You have some cooperation with AMLO, but increasingly there's a desire to essentially say, okay, well, you want us to stop doing this. Well, what are you willing to do
right,
for us?
Right. Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College, on the road in Medellin, Colombia. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.